I grew up in the Mennonite church of the 60s and 70s when there were lots of teaching and preaching about end times. It was a frequent subject in regular Sunday morning sermons, but revival meetings were also in their heyday, and the second coming of Christ was a common topic in revival preaching. At least once a year, our church would invite in a guest preacher for revival meetings, preaching every night of the week, always including an altar call, some appeal to be ready for the return of Christ. I dug around some old Parkview Church files a while back and found that we did that here as well during those decades. Parkview often had these revival meetings between Palm Sunday and Easter, what we now call Holy Week, but we never used that term. That was before Mennonites had ever heard of Advent and Lent and such. The late G. Irvin Lehman holds the record, I think, for the most sermons preached in a week at Parkview. One year he preached 9 sermons in 8 days. Started Palm Sunday morning and then every night for 7 days and ended Easter Sunday morning. I asked G. Irvin about it some years back before he died, and he sort of remembered that. I would surmise that every one of those 9 services was well attended, and every one of those services included an invitation to be made right with Christ as a first-time commitment or a renewal, because we needed to be ready since nobody knew when Christ would return. I don't speak of this era of the church critically in any way. For its time, I think those methods of revival meetings and so on made sense for how we saw the world and for what we believed faithfulness looked like in the world. And revival meetings often did have good outcomes. Persons became more dedicated to following Jesus in life. They renewed their commitment to mission work or service abroad. They deepened their life in the Spirit. All good. But this was also a time in the church when some things, at least as I see it, got a little skewed. The same period saw the publishing of Hal Lindsey's books, The Late Great Planet Earth. Many of our Mennonite young people and adults ate it up. Hal Lindsey in the 1970s and the Left Behind series of more recent decades all promoted a literalist, premillennial, dispensational eschatology. Those are technical terms, of course, meaningless to most of you, that the church used to argue over vehemently. And there's more terms where that came from. I won't even mention the subsets of premillennialism, like pre-tribulation, post-trib, and mid-trib, causes of many a church split. To say it in plain English, dispensationalists believe we can divide God's work in history into distinct ages or dispensations where God works in different ways with different moral expectations of us humans. It's a way to deal with the conflicts between, say, the Old and New Testament God that we see. It's also a way to explain what's going on in the world now. Hal Lindsey and others saw the world in 1970 as on the brink of the rapture and the return of Christ. Frequent famines and wars and earthquakes were a sign. International alliances were a sign. The growing communist threat was a sign. 1970 looked like the beginning of the last dispensation. That's the church I grew up in, feeling that any day, Christ would come back in a cataclysmic rapture and take the faithful up into heaven if you were ready. And then would come a 7-year period of great tribulation on the earth. That is, if you were a pre-trib premillennialist. When I was a teen, our church showed the film Thief in the Night, showing some Christians being taken in the rapture and some being left behind with Larry Norman on the soundtrack singing, "I wish we'd all been ready." That film, and I'm choosing my words carefully and accurately, scared the hell out of me. And presumably the heaven into me. It used fear as of the fear of being left behind as a primary motivation to live a faithful Christian life. And my young mind and spirit were susceptible to this fear. How well I remember some sleepless nights wondering if this would be the last one and worrying I might not be ready. Since EMU's Centennial History book just came out, let me jump back a few decades earlier and point out that end times theology was a source of great controversy and conflict in the early days of Eastern Mennonite College. Premillennialism was the predominant view on campus and generally among Mennonites in the East. Bible prof C.K. Layman was one of a few amillennialists that did not buy into that popular timeline. Harold Layman can tell you more about his family dynamics. As some of you know, we live in the house on College Avenue that Harold grew up in. His father, Professor and Bishop D.W. Layman, was a premillennialist and did not see eye to eye with his fellow professor and brother who lived next door, C.K. Layman. So the arguments didn't only happen on the EMU campus. They found their way, I suppose, into family gatherings, probably around the table at Thanksgiving and Christmas, and Harold could probably tell some stories. But those were just not just abstract theological arguments. They could determine how people prioritize their lives. The belief that Christ would return in the near term, before the millennium, gave these early Mennonites strong motivation to engage in mission work and evangelism and service overseas. It was an act of compassion not only to feed the hungry, but to see that their souls were saved before it was too late. I imagine if it were not for this premillennial motivation that some Mennonite hospitals in India, for instance, may never have been built over 100 years ago. And inner-city mission churches in Chicago and Philadelphia would not have been founded, which gave us rural Mennonites a head start on bridging some of the divisive racial hostilities that boiled up in the cities during the Civil Rights era. So in today's more enlightened way of thinking, so to speak, we might want to congratulate ourselves on that we're not being so foolish anymore. We're not arguing and dividing the church over silly things like whether we get raptured before, during, or after the Great Tribulation. But what if the way we look at the end actually did make a difference in how we live now? And if so, how should we look at the end? And how should we live? That seems like a worthwhile question to ponder. And it's precisely the question that the writer of 2 Peter was posing to the church of that day. Did you hear this a few minutes ago? Since all these things are to be dissolved in this way, what sort of persons ought you to be? Verse 11. In 2 Peter 3, that question shows up in the middle of a section describing the end times. How then shall we live? And the writer summarizes, therefore, beloved, while you are waiting for these things, strive to be found by him at peace. The date and authorship of 2 Peter are disputed. But no matter when it was actually written down and by whom, the writer clearly intends us to read it as a letter from the Apostle Peter in the mid-60s AD, just before Peter was martyred by Nero. The church during the time of the apostles believed that the return of Jesus was just around the bend, as in maybe in a few weeks or a couple months, but very, very soon. They had good reason to think that. They had a living memory of Jesus. Jesus' own words were still ringing in their ears, "I'm coming back." Not only that, they were suffering a time of severe persecution. The sword of the empire and the power of religious leaders were pressing in on them. So the idea that Jesus was about to come and whisk them away from the horror that was life on this earth, that was a compelling idea, as you might imagine. Their view of the end determined how they lived. Since the end was coming so soon, some of them quit their jobs. Some of them walked away from marriages. Some of them sold homes and possessions and just hunkered down to wait it out together. It was a reasonable response to their time of suffering and their belief that the end was near at hand. The letter of 2 Peter is specifically trying to change that mindset. No, he writes, it's not time to hunker down and wait it out and forget about your other responsibilities. It's time to keep discerning how to live faithfully now. Be at peace with your neighbors and live with holiness and justice and righteousness now, not just in a future age. The Lord is not slow as we regard slowness, verse 9. With the Lord, 1,000 years are like a day, and a day is like 1,000 years. God is patient. So should you be patient, Peter says. Things are going to get worse before they get better, verses 10 to 12. But there will be a new heaven and a new earth. The timing is not clear to us, but God is moving. God is on a trajectory. God is moving toward our salvation and the salvation of all whom God loves, not wanting anyone to perish. Verses 9 and 15. So Peter exhorts the church. This is not a time to pull back from engagement in the world. It's a time to engage. This is a time to live in holiness. This is a time to be found blameless and at peace. The more I thought about those words to the early church, who believed in the imminent return of Christ, the more I saw parallels to our own context. No, we may not live with a day-to-day expectation of being raptured. Think about this. The world today is in turmoil, and the church is under duress. So how should a stressed and wounded church live in a broken and desperate world? I think that was the question facing the early church. Maybe as in the days of Peter and the apostles, what we believe about the end will make a difference in how we live in turbulent times. In our anxiety and fear, do we get reactive and defensive and lash out at those who threaten us? Or, in our feeling threatened, do we pull away from society and hunker down, shutting out the pain of the world as if we are in some underground bomb shelter? Or do we say, the only thing that matters is our spiritual well-being, so just ignore the world that's falling apart around us, God's going to take care of it, focus only on our personal relationship with Jesus, and live in joyful oblivion? Those are choices people make, Christian people make, influenced by what they think about the end. And those choices seem to be either fight or flight. I think there's a better choice than fight or flight. Call it transformative engagement.